So this, a little caveat before I get started. One was that this was supposed to be the session before, and then the one on the prophetic church was supposed to be last. But with what Pastor Terry was doing, it seemed like a better flow. But here's why this would have been first, because I still think this is really important. I think that we get ourselves into some difficult waters, spiritually speaking, when we get into the prophetic ministries and we have not been building our contemplative core. One of my favorite guys is Father Richard Rohr, and he founded the Center for Action and Contemplation in New Mexico. And people ask, what is the most important? Center for Action and Contemplation. Is it action or contemplation? He said, the most important word is and. Center for Action and Contemplation. And that really, he says, as he's been doing his work, they thought they would do 50-50, like here's action things and here's contemplative practices. He's found that most people really, what we need, I should put the microphone on. Well, most people, what they really need is about 90% contemplative practice. I think this is especially true in the mainline church, where we do care deeply about a lot of social issues, and we start to go into them with a lot of energy, but that energy has to be grounded. We have to be filling our cup along the way. And so this is what we're going to look at, is how do we do that together, and how do we do that as individuals? So is this on?
Can you say what prophetic ministry
the prophetic is? Prophetic ministry, the speaking on behalf of God. So like when you think that God's truth needs to be spoken into a social issue, then we don't know whatever that issue is, then it's the willingness to speak about biblical issues and those sort of things. So that's what I mean by that. Sort of think of all the prophets. What is Isaiah doing? Amos doing? In fact, I think that Jesus is coming out of the Hebrew prophets school. I think that's what he thought he was, that he was standing in line with all these different prophets and trying to speak prophetic ministry. All right, so we're going to begin as we do with some conspiracy. Breathing together, and I'm going to teach you a technique that we'll do for a couple minutes here that I learned when I was in Plum Village, which is a Buddhist retreat center in France that was founded and run by Thich Nhat Hanh. And so he has a really great way of teaching meditation. So here's what we're going to do. Please put your feet flat on the floor or be ready to sort of sit upright. But here's the thing. So you're going to have your hands open to receive or down to ground yourself, whichever you feel like you need. And then as you breathe in, say in your mind, present moment. And as you breathe out, say in your mind, wonderful moment. And this is the most important part, put a smile on your face for the whole time. Okay? So let's begin.
What was the second part?
Wonderful moment. This is All the True Vows by David White. All the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak out loud are the ones we break. There is only one life you can call your own, and 1,000 others you can call by any name you want. Hold to the truth you make every day with your own body. Do not turn your face away. Hold to your own truth at the center of the image you were born with. Those who do not understand their destiny will never understand the friends that they've made, nor the work that they've chosen, nor the one life that waits beyond all the others. By the lake, in the wood, in the shadows, you can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the water. Whatever you hear from the water, remember. It wants you to carry the sound of its truth on your lips. Remember, in this place, no one can hear you, and out of the silence, you can make a promise it will kill you to break. That way, you'll find what is real and what is not. I know what I'm saying. Time almost forsook me, and I looked again. Seeing my reflection, I broke a promise and spoke for the first time after all these years in my own voice, before it was too late to turn my face again. Audience participation time. What is faith? When you hear this word, faith, what would you say it is? How would you define Faith.
Trust.
Trust. Came from my church.
Gift from God.
Was that a gift from God? You got to have faith. What are we saying?
We don't know. There's no way to prove it.
No way to prove it? Ah, interesting. Okay.
Believe. Optimism.
Optimism. Great. Was that? Someone say believe.
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 Hope.
You know that believe comes from the Old English by life? It was supposed to be something that's like you were living into it. We've changed belief, I think, into I have opinions about it. Right? It's sort of synonymous sometimes. But you're right. Believe is definitely a core of it. Yeah.
If I didn't have it, I don't know where I would be.
If you didn't have it, oh, that's interesting. So it's existential in that sense, right? If you didn't have it, you didn't know where you would be.
Yes.
Or maybe who you'd be.
Yeah, but piggyback on that, that's what gets me out of bed.
Interesting.
More
Right.
Letting go of my control.
Letting go, wow, that's good. Yeah, one analogy that I've thought of is I can believe that planes can fly.
Yeah.
I can study aerodynamics, I can see them. But faith is getting in one, right?
Right.
I mean, one's an opinion, the other is I'm involved. That's the difference, I think. Here's the thing that I want to be clear about. Doubt does not equal unbelief, right? I think that there's an important thing. We often think of that the opposite of faith is doubt. Doubting Thomas Sunday, the Sunday after Easter, is always just been a... Poor Thomas has been a punching bag for 2,000 years. It had nothing to do with that. Yeah, go ahead.
Every time I preach about Thomas, I call him skeptical Thomas.
Yeah.
He was not doubting Thomas.
I would say, go even further, scientific Thomas.
Yes.
Right? inquisitive Thomas. Thomas who was getting milk when everyone else got exactly what he wanted. Right? Because they all got the deal. He was out for some reason. And he shows up and goes, yeah, I want what you had.
Yeah.
I'm not going to take it on your word. Yeah. Yeah, that guy. So Paul Tillich says... Doubt isn't the opposite of faith, it's an element of faith. Here's why that's important. I think that the opposite of faith is certainty. When I know, that makes me do crazy things in the world. I no longer can be touched by God because I know. There's no more humility in me. Every time that we grow in faith, it's because we doubted something that we previously thought. And that's an important growing process. It's a painful growing process. But if you believed everything the same way now that you did when you first went to Sunday school, well, that's called fundamentalism at some level, right? I mean, that's sometimes where people get, I can't let go of certain things. But what I want to say is, the letting go of certain things is actually how we grow, how we test those things, how we... So I think I'm a big fan of Thomas, the patron saint of asking questions, of seeking. I think that's an okay thing to do. Notice what Jesus does with Thomas, by the way. I mean, he shows him. Shows up. Says, what do you need? You want to do this? You want to touch that? Here? We good? Right? That's good. So basically, that's what he does. There was no... I mean, there's a little slight, like, you know, blessed are those who have not seen... That's a little soft, like, you know, you could have taken my word for it. But instead, there is no rejection with Jesus at all. Instead, he welcomes the question. He understands it. You've heard this analogy about, you know, the elephant. I think that this is important when we think about interfaith and even our own understanding of God or faith or our spirituality. We're all coming at it from different perspectives. And so whenever we're talking about faith, we all ought to take our shoes off because we're on holy ground. Where it's other people's opinions are important. In fact, we say at our church at the beginning, we'll welcome everybody and we'll say to people, if this is your first time, thank you for coming. Your presence here makes our community more complete. In other words, I can't know God the way I want to know God until I hear how you know God. Because otherwise, it's just me confirming my own stuff all the time. Or we get a group of people who we kind of all think alike, and as long as we keep it that way, then none of us really grow. So what we need is the people who come in who have radically different understandings and say, you know, I'm a spiritual seeker too, and here's what I think. And to have that space for that before we quickly, as we've often done in our history, go right to judgment and figure out whether it's heresy or not. Remember, the number one thing, if you take anything from the week with me, is replace judgment with curiosity. Super important. We in church, we're often trained to have our judgment muscle super overdeveloped, and our curiosity muscle is not there. And I think we had to completely flip that script, right? So that's what we're trying to do with some of the stuff we're doing here. So
they're all blindfolded. I just noticed.
Yeah, that's how they can't see around the rest of it. They're saying the whole setup is like all these people who are blindfolded trying to figure out what an elephant is. So they're just doing it by touch.
But you're making the analogy that that's what the church is like?
Yes. Well, actually, it's what we're all like. That we all have
we project our own.
Yeah, we have our own way of saying, this is what I think God is like. God is like this. Okay. But you may have a very different view, and I should listen to you because we don't have the whole truth in my
hands. Take the blinders off.
Exactly. Yeah. Or if you can't, right? Or the way in which we take the blinders off, I think, is to listen in that analogy to other people, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Right? All right, so what I want to say is faith is this. It's trust and openness. It's a way of trusting, not being certain, and it's an openness to being able to learn and to develop, right? So what would a faithful people, how would we worship together? Okay, quick analogy. I love yoga. I've been doing it for about 10 years, and I've noted something. While churches have been in decline, yoga studios are not. They're blossoming. Here's what doesn't happen when you go. How many people do yoga? All right, so some people know what we're talking. So when you go to yoga, here's what you don't do. You don't sit down and watch someone do yoga. Right? You practice yoga. And it doesn't matter if this is your first time there. You're encouraged by the instructor to do what you can and to pay attention to your body and to not overdo and to try and figure out how to participate in as many of the poses as you can. As you continue, you begin to be able to do more and more and more. It is a participatory, I think that it's in some ways reminding us of what is missing in our corporate worship. Because even though we say liturgy is the work of the people, and oftentimes, what was the word, the phrase that you used? It is the thing of the guy up front. When there's one guy, it's the show. We talk about the show?
Oh, yeah, sage on the stage.
The sage on the stage. Yeah, exactly. That oftentimes the way we do it is, you know, kind of what we're doing right now. There's one person's talking, people are listening. But yet the thing is, it's collectively, we're all supposed to be practicing together, right? So when we do our spirituality, the beautiful part about contemplative practices is that they are inherently participatory. Now, we have a lot of things we do together. We sing together. That's beautiful. We pray together, kind of. We take communion together. We do some standing and sitting together. There's some things we kind of do together. But if you are, you can take it as a spectator deal, right? I mean, here's two different worship communities. Right? Yeah. The top one is what you're most familiar with, at least what I am, in most churches, right? And the bottom one is St. Gregory of Nyssa in San Francisco. It's an Episcopal church in which, so the table's in the middle, and everyone comes around, they dance this great dance where you put your hand on the person next to you, and you practice a step, you know, you kind of do this thing together as you're singing this chant. And I'm telling you, it's a different experience, right? You are in a different way. And they also have a whole other room over here where there's the place for the word. So you gather here in this room here. The only furniture is that table in the middle. You have the opening rite, you sing, and then you follow these umbrellas that they, I don't see them there, but you follow these umbrellas to the room over here, and then you sit facing each other, and there's a lectern where someone reads, and then there's a place where someone who's going to preach is going to sit, and then after the person preaches, then there's a silence, and then they say, the sermon continues through us, and people pipe up about what they think, what they heard, what they want to say. And then you go back over here, and you gather around, you do the communion liturgy, and at the end of it, they just bring all the coffee and the goodies to that same table, and it's a fellowship hall.
Oh,
and it's beautiful, right? But it's participatory. They never plan, other than who's going to be preaching and the main music leader, no one else is planned. So when you walk in the first time, you might be handed, could you read this reading? Can you help with this part? And they, when they do communion, they just break up the bread and hand chunks to people, and everyone starts communing each other throughout, right? So it's, and the idea is, it's the work of us. I strongly recommend you go there. The same place, by the way, on Fridays becomes a food pantry that Sarah Miles runs that feeds about 600-700 people every single Friday. And they have fresh produce that they get from the San Francisco Food Bank, and they have oftentimes musicians like a string quartet, and they let people go in smaller groups so that they can shop and have the sense of the dignity of looking for what they want and shopping. It's beautiful. So if you go, what's that?
Saint
Gregory of Nyssa.
Of Nyssa, thank you.
Episcopal Church in the Mission District of San Francisco.
One other thing that I noticed about this is, I don't know if that's a small person walking out or a child, I can't really tell, but it seems like this way would be much more open to the participation of children, because they like to be involved, they're participatory, and, you know, we have a church that, you know, if your child is crying, people look at you and you go out to sit in the outside. You know, it's like, it's different here.
It's very different, very different. In fact, right out here, this is a fountain, and that's where they do baptisms, right? Outside there, right? And then all around here, if you could look up on the walls, is images of all the saints with one hand next to each other doing exactly what you're doing, but it's like all the saints of history, and they also include non-Christian saints. Malcolm X is up there. Martha Graham's up there. Gandhi's up there. Einstein's up there. And the point is, they asked their community, who should be in the Dancing Saints mural? And that's what they came up with, right? So it's awesome. Yeah. Go for Friday, though, too. So Brian McLaren wrote this book that I would highly recommend called The Great Migration, The Great Spiritual Migration. And in that, he talks about what he thinks churches can be together. He calls them schools of love. I think that that's a really great way to think about what it is that we're about. So I'm going to go through a couple different things here that he suggests about elements of the worship service and see what you think. For the welcome, I'm just going to read this to you. Imagine if the first words of welcome each Sunday went like this. Welcome, everyone. This community of faith has one great aim: to help people grow in love for neighbor, self, the earth, and God. That's why we've come together, and that's why we're glad that you're here. Okay? Prayer. What if our public prayers consistently reflected this great aim to grow in love, and our prayers addressed specifically and boldly obstacles to love like selfishness, greed, addiction, lust, pride, racism, religious bigotry, nationalism, ideology, apathy, perfectionism, unhealed trauma, and fear, right? Confession. Imagine if love, not law, were the standard by which we learn to examine ourselves and confess our sins against God, neighbor, and earth we share. Imagine if each week we were guided into the kind of self-examination that helped us name and turn from our unloving acts in recent days. And imagine if, along with confessing our sins, we confessed or named our hurts, the places where others have wounded us, so that we could process our pain and then respond in a way that doesn't give in to resentment or revenge. Now, I love this next one. Creeds, confessions. What if we wrote new creeds that put love in the spotlight? Imagine if reciting a statement of beliefs, we spoke confessions of love, beginning with, we love, rather than we believe. Imagine, just finish that statement. We love, and just keep on going. Wouldn't that be an exciting way to... Communion. Imagine if we separated our understanding of the Eucharist once and for all from the language of divine appeasement, and instead celebrated the Eucharist as a family table, a love feast, a bonding to Jesus and his life and message of love, an experience of mutual self-giving with God as the event of communion. And it just goes on and on. Sermons. The sermons would be used to... people, how are we struggling to love? That would be the way in which we talk about that together, maybe letting people share with each other and then processing that. Imagine if churches in the offering taught about giving not as duty, but not as a bargain, give and you'll get, but as an expression of love. And then songs. What if for the next 300 years we sang about love and justice, which has been defined by philosopher Cornel West as what love looks like in public? So while sin and forgiveness are important themes, what if we're just to sing, let's choose a little other part of it for a while and see if we couldn't, because what you sing gets into your heart way more so than what you say. I mean, I talk to anyone who's visited folks who are suffering from Alzheimer's, and when everything else is gone, you can sing with them and they will remember exactly the words of the songs that they sung, right? And then church design. What if our church buildings were decorated with symbols of and quotations about love? What if the basin and the towel, symbols of loving service, and the bread and the cup, symbols of self-giving love, became as important as the cross in our buildings? Interesting stuff. So get the book, check it out. I think that there's a lot of things we can do together. I want to focus the rest of our time, though, on what we can do more. Can be corporate, but really it's also things you can do on your own. Over here, drawn this. This is my art. This is why I will never, ever be able to draw things like Ann Erlander did. Because that's it. That's it. That's the level. All contemplative practices at some level, what they're trying to do is help us move from the false self. This is what Thomas Merton called the false self, which is who we think we need to be. You got this messages from all sorts of places in our lives, from ourself, from our families, from society, from your church. Who do you need to be in order to be whole and to make God happy? Over here, to who your true self is who you already are. So this is not a ladder thing. This is not trying to figure out, because that'd be one more thing you got to do. But instead, the contemplative practices are attempting to wake us up, reconnect us with what is already true for us, what is already okay for us, right? So that's important to remember when we start to look at some of these different things. As I mentioned earlier, this is a Plum Village in France, and it's just a wonderful place for, and they accept anybody, if you want to go and be part of this, you can be with the monks and the nuns. There's other one in Escondido, California, Deer Park Monastery, that's also wonderful. I've been there. I went there as part of my sabbatical. I wanted to experience this. And so I spent time there. And Thich Nhat Hanh actually was there because they were doing this Dharma transmissions thing. So it was a real treat to be able to be there with him. He was 83 at the time. Here's my confession to you. I was a pastor for 15 years. And what this week of just doing this meditation with them showed me was how much I did not understand prayer. I thought that I prayed, but what I did was say prayers. It's not that those are bad things, but the sitting in the presence of the present moment and listening, just listening, powerful. It's amazing. And what happened to me was just, it was like an awakening. It was a sense of, I realized most of my prayers were me telling God things that I think God must not be aware of. Maybe you're not paying attention, God. Here's some things. I'm going to give you a little to-do list. Here's a to-do list. I'm sure you're listening. Right? Or sort of things that are bothering me. Right? And as soon as I get those things off my chest, it's almost like God was like, ah, and off I go. Right? Off to my next thing. Like it's a two-way street. Prayer is supposed to be where you also, in fact, listen. Even more so, listen. Think about our prayers in church. Where's the listening? We listen to the pastor, we listen to the reader, but when do we listen to in the silence to God? Silence is tough in our church, right? It's dead air. So after a while, people start looking around, who's supposed to stand up right now? So this, you get together with these folks, first thing in the morning, 5:45, you're supposed to be on your mat, 45 minutes of silence. That's your first one. You know, it happened several times during the day. And I thought, this is just not going to work for an ADD guy like me. But it did. It's pretty amazing. The key was, I'll show you the thing a little bit. It was about walking meditation, really, was my doorway in. This is what something that Thich Nhat Hanh says. If you want peace, you have to be peace. This is a very different mentality than I think a lot of us in the Western church. We always say, if you want peace, work for justice. Right? And you've heard that before. If you want peace, work for justice. It's not that it's wrong. It's just that Thich Nhat Hanh's corrective will be, first, you need to be peace inside. That, I think, is important for us to hear. That we have to have done some work so that when we show up at whatever it is we're trying to work for justice, we've already reconciled and become peaceful inside our own hearts and souls. We've made that transition to recognizing we are already home. You couldn't become more the apple of God's eye, the perfect being that God imagined, than you are right now. There's nothing you have to do. It's already yours.
It reminds me of a story that we heard in Terry's class, I think it was either this morning or yesterday morning.
Yeah.
We were there. The attorney who was helping refugees who had been separated from their kids. And as she left the ICE offices, she was accosted by people who were protesting the separation.
Uh-huh.
Angrily. It sounded like it was a pretty terrifying experience for her. It didn't sound like that they were there as much.
Have you been to any of these protests?
I haven't.
I have. The one thing I would say for critique for my side is that there's a ton of anger that's coming forward, and I get the anger. I'm not saying that anger is bad. What I'm saying is, if we're supposed to be coming from a place of some spiritual depth, the anger should be tempered with compassion, too. There should be a way in which you're feeling, you should sense that the person who is upset also loves you, right? That's really important. That was the absolute core of Dr. King's work, was that it's not just the liberation of African Americans that he was seeking. It was the liberation of the white community as well. And if you don't love the white community as well, then we don't actually heal together. And so he understood that when you had to practice, so that when you are in the lunch counter and they're abusing you, you don't respond with rage. When they stick the dogs on you and the hoses on you, that you don't respond with violence. And that is super hard. So what they did was they would make pre-decisions before they got there that they were already going to pre-forgive the people around them. That's important work. And I find it absent from a lot of our discussion when we do protests and stuff today. I think it's important for us to reclaim that inner core about being peace. I'm going to give you this. Here's just a little thing. Now hear this. This became a huge, helpful thing to me. When you are going through your day and the phone rings, the person's at the door, someone comes in your office, whatever it is, if you can just take a moment and say to yourself, now hear this. I am in this time, I am in this place, and whatever is coming through is what I'm going to focus on. Right? That little bit has helped me tremendously towards being able to get out of my story about how busy I am or how I don't, or try to figure out what this person, before they say anything, what they want from me. This goes a long way towards, it's just a quick thing you can do. Right? Before you pick up the phone, okay, phone call's coming in. Now, hear this. I'm in my body, I'm in my time, in my place, and I pick up the phone. The energy shift is huge. So just give it a shot, see what you think. Right? This was my doorway into being able to do other types of meditation. First of all, meditation has one main goal, what I said, try to help you connect with your true self, but there's thousands and thousands of ways to meditate. When you think meditation is just sitting on a cushion and you got to sit still and just do that, that's not the only way. For me, walking meditation was the doorway in. So this is, they teach it there at these retreat centers. You walk kind of aimlessly. You pay attention to the feel of the earth underneath you, on your breathing. And as you're doing so, just like this Thich Nhat Hanh, you smile, right? If you have a little child nearby and you take their hand, so much the better, right? It kind of changes your energy when you're walking. I love doing walking meditation in airports. It's a great thing. There's so much stress, so much, you know, whatever going on. I love being able to just walk and smile and see people, and it changes me. And it's interesting. Some people they'll say interesting things to you when you're just walking around smiling at people. All right.
What are you up to?
Yeah, what's going on? I mean, it's like, you seem happy. I am. Because there's not a lot of happiness in a place like an airport. Now, I didn't come up with that. That's what Thich Nhat Hanh did. And I thought one time when I had a long layover, like, all right, I'll give it a try. Now I love doing it. It's super fun. Find, you know, especially if you're with some other people and they can watch your bags so you don't have to be carrying things. And then just wander and smile at people. It's pretty great. All right. We talked a little bit about this, about the importance of silence. Let me ask the question. When do you find silence in your day?
Early morning?
Do you take time for it?
Yeah, I go right outside. I might take a cup of coffee with me.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, even in the winter.
Yeah. Others, yeah.
In the morning, before prayer.
Before prayer? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doing Tai Chi.
That's great.
Around sunset.
Sunset for you?
In the morning, I have my cat sit in my lap.
Nice. So you have a guide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my cat's great.
Yeah. I have dogs, and dogs are fantastic too for providing that energy. They'll sit with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those of us who are blessed with age have to get up sometimes in the middle of the
night. I'm beginning to learn this.
There you go. Quiet.
And it's sometimes hard to go back to sleep.
Yeah.
I cherish that.
Yeah.
Instead of being frustrated because here I am going through changes. So that's my quiet time.
That's a great example. It's a great example because you can't change the circumstance. You can change your reaction to the circumstance.
Yeah.
And you're looking at it as blessing and opportunity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful. I just encourage it and maybe even do that with people. That's another... When we think about silence, we also think about solitude. That's another cultural thing. That's okay. But think about being quiet with someone else, too. It can be intimate. I'm just saying. I mean, sitting together with someone and just being quiet, wow. I mean, that could be a great thing, especially if it's intentional. If you just ran out of things to say in the car, I'm saying, it's like, you know, it's like, hey, let's just sit together for like 5 minutes. Just sit together. Right? It's pretty great. Yeah. So, okay. Oh, by the way, all these things I should have pointed out earlier. Heather is here in the back. She is your spiritual director here at the village, and she, I'm sure, can teach you or help you with any of these things that we're talking about. So it's important to do. Lectio Divina. How many people know what this is? Raise your hand if you've ever done Lectio Divina. This is a great way of studying scripture. It's best done in some small groups. You read scripture with not with what Pastor Terry was teaching, which was excellent, about going back the archaeological understanding and trying to re-tease that out. You're not doing any word searches or anything. What you're doing is you're listening for God to speak through the words. Right? It doesn't even have to be what the text is about. So you can say, let's just read like Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. Right? You may just read that. And then you stop, have some silence, and you read it again. Another voice. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. And you listen, which of those words that we say is shimmered for you, which one stood out? Which word in that grabbed you? Read it a third time, and you think, now when you think about the word, as you listen to that again, what's an emotion that comes up with it? So now you may have, like, it's like, want. That was the word, want. And the emotion that came along with it was sadness or something like that. I'm just making this up, right? Then you would take those two things, want and sadness, and maybe it's time for you to do some journaling, maybe some art, some other things. You do take some time, then you come back together and you'd share what it is that happened for you in that time in a context that is confidential and also safe for everybody. That process of doing it has yielded incredible results for me, and I know for other people too. It's very powerful. So maybe try it out. Go back to your church and say, why don't we practice some Lectio Divina? I bet you someone knows what that is. Centering prayer is another it's another method for doing prayer together. There's a whole program. Thomas Keating is he was the one who sort of like popularized this way of doing things. But you can go online, Centering Prayer, and there's tons and tons of resources. This one, I think, is helpful. This is St. Ignatius of Loyola, right? And it's called the Examine. And it's really simple. So you start, become aware of God's grace, just take a little time. Then you think about your day. What gave you life? What brought life to you? And then just practice some gratitude for it. Say thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that chipmunk. Thank you for the sunlight that was hitting the water. Thank you for my beloved. Thank you for whatever it was that gave you life. Just say thank you, thank you. Then think about what took life from you. Well, this part made me sad. This is what I probably did that took life from somebody else. Become aware of it. And then either forgive it or let it go. Right? That's the next thing that happens after that. And then think about tomorrow and ask, so now, based on where you are, what do you need tomorrow? God, help me with patience because I'm going to my mother-in-law. So. Or help me with, I mean, whatever it is that's coming up, give me some wisdom. I've got a meeting that I'm really concerned about. Or I just am going to need more a sense of your presence. And then ask. And then that's what you do the last thing in the day before you go to bed. Is this examine. The beauty of this is this can be done with children and grandchildren. You can, and it's so simple. You just sit with them and you say, let's just take a moment together and think about our day. What was the best part of the day? What part didn't you like? And you say thank you for the good things and let's let go of the bad things. And then say, well, what is it that you hope for tomorrow? And then kids will tell you, and it becomes their practice that you can do with them. So real simple. If you look up Ignatian Examine or any of that, you can find it. Pilgrimages are something that we've been doing at our congregation. We try and do this. We've been doing it every other year, probably going to become an every year thing. This is the Basilica of St. Francis in Assisi. So we do one that's based on the life of St. Francis. We've done ones to Ireland. This next summer, we're going to be going to Leipzig and Prague, focused on singing revolutions and the way in which people have used song to defeat oppression and tyranny. And so it's just a chance to go together. We always plan time for just doing whatever you want to do, so we only program like half a day. And so we've had 25 people go on each of these trips, and it's really a great opportunity to bond as a group, but also I think you get more done spiritually speaking on these 10-day trips than you do in a month of Sundays. So because it's something that happens to us. You leave your home, you're in a different place. And so I strongly recommend going on any sort of pilgrimage type thing. And you can pilgrimage to any place, but this place, is a place of pilgrimage for a lot of folks, right? Generosity. I think that this is one of the cardinal virtues of the future church, is we should be places that excel in generosity. Just outdo ourselves in being able to just give. And I'm talking money. So if you figuring out how can you, whatever your personal budget, your church budget, your family budget, and trying to just put yourself some little growth goals. I want to give a little bit more. I want to figure out how to give a little bit more. It just has to be between you and God, people in your family, what you want to do. But I think that it really does something, especially in our culture that is so focused on consumption and materialism. Practicing generosity is the antidote. We talk about the offering in our church as a mini exorcism. That the dollar, our possessions have, there's a reason they're called possessions. They have the power to possess us. And you can talk all you want about how it has no control over your life, but the only way to exorcise that demon is to write a check. Right? If you actually do let it go, and that's why we do it in church. That's why we have offering in church. Because if it was just a fundraising thing or a way of funding an institution, well, there's way more simple ways to do this. But we do it as part of the worship service because we say, this thing has no power over me, God does. Right? I renounce it. Try it out that way. Maybe, get an exorcist. Practicing hospitality. There are so many ways in which this could be applied to our lives. At our homes, in our churches, how many ways do we say inadvertently to people, you're not really welcome here? It happens as soon as, for a lot of us, when we drive up to the church parking lot. The cars that are there tell you right now whether this is your community or not. Right? Right? I mean, if you come rocking up in your, giant Silverado that's lifted up with the Trump sticker on the back, and that's all Priuses, this might not be your community. Right? It's also a socioeconomic thing. Right? If you're driving four bald tires on the best car that you can have, and you're just trying to keep it together, and you show up and it's Lexus and BMW, it's a way of saying to folks, this may not be for you. So we have to overcome any of those barriers. How many things we do in our worship services or in our house or anything that says, you're not really fully welcome, right? I mean, all the thing around ADA access, right? How many times do we have churches, ours is one, where if you are a person in a wheelchair, you could not preside where we have our table, right? I mean, that's an issue. We'd have to move the table and think about that because there's lots of ways in which we say you can't fully be part of this community. Here's one of my favorite things to do. Invite people over to dinner. It's a spiritual practice. Is there anything more fun in the world than having people that you care about over for a whole evening of just a dinner and hanging out? I mean, I think that and we ought to reclaim it as saying, do it on a regular basis, but always try and include someone that wouldn't be normally in that group. I make that as a spiritual goal too, to say, let's invite some other different folks to be, not just the folks that we know, to try and increase that circle wider. All right. I played you a song last time, I'm going to play you another song. This song gets at our preciousness, and let's let you listen to it.
Inside the tunnels, the stone tunnels, are the trains. And inside the trains, the steel trains, are the bags of skin. And inside the thin skin are the blood and the bones. And inside the blood and the bones are the dreams. It really is that simple. It really is that fragile. I am one such dream inside the blood and the bags and the bones and the trains and the tunnels. And there's a dream sitting next to me, and there's a dream across from me. Fragile. Now we all know that one day the tunnels will crumble and the trains will stop and the blood and the bags and the bones will be gone. And in between now and then, we know something must happen to every dream. I don't know what will happen to the other dreams, but I know what will happen to me. Sure as the rain, I know. Sure as the winter. I'll breathe and grieve and struggle and strive and love. And if I am lucky, once, just once, the dream will drop to the floor like a vase and shatter in shards of silence. But I will see in the pattern of the pieces, I will see something. This will happen. But now that train, with all its precious cargo, rolls on.
Yeah, I love that song. It's we are indeed we're dreams, and so is everybody else, right? And when we get that, we get that all of our true selves are already whole, and that everyone else also is a true self with its own dream. That is the goal of what our spiritual community is supposed to be about. My dream for our community would be eventually that it would run like a yoga studio, right? That every single day there'd be 5, 6, 7 times during the day where anyone in the community could come by for Lectio Divina or yoga classes or centering prayer or any of the things. Or like you were mentioning, people get together and play music or do art together or any of it. If it helps you recognize who you are as a dream, as a whole person, then it's worthwhile. Right? And I think that it's got a great opportunity for us to reclaim what it is that God wanted us to do. These schools of love that help people actualize their dream. Thoughts? What do you want to ask? You've got about a little bit of time, kind of giving you a ton of stuff.
So
it's my last time talking,
this,
so I'm good.
You've tried these things at your church.
We've tried lots of them at our church. We have a regular yoga practice we do out here.
In the city, or
yeah, we're near the city. Yeah, we're in the beach community. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. Since we started having, we have yoga about 5 days a week now. Since we started that process, we have a lot of people who go to yoga with us, but they aren't part of the rest of the community. Right? Same thing's been true when we do. Every Friday, there's a meal for people who are on the street. Some people come do that. They don't come on Sunday. I think we have to broaden our understanding of when we're being church. To be sure, we want to have a worship community, but that's all right. People do what they're going to do.
Exactly. I just want to share an example of something like that. Our church, I have a bluegrass jam at my church.
Yeah.
And for a long time, it was just sort of this, it's gained momentum over a couple of years, and I was keep holding it indoors, and it was really for people in the church and some music friends that I had that just wanted to have a daytime jam instead of nighttime jam. And I started holding it out, because we have nice weather this summer, out on the, we have this breezeway that's open to people walking on the sidewalk as they walk past the church, and there have been people coming up just out of the blue and sitting and listening. And I realized, I didn't really think about this until only just the last couple of weeks, that they're really getting the church experience by just being here and enjoying themselves. And that's all that's needed.
I think that's right. I think in these times, inviting people to church is a little dicey. Inviting people to dinner, easier. Inviting people to a musical jam session or a yoga class or whatever, easier. And I think all of them are doorways for us. And you find it should be driven exactly like your example on, it sort of bubble up.
Yeah, right? It's not expecting.
Exact that, right?
At all.
When you do it, it's like programmed, like we're going to throw this out there. Those things don't tend to go so well. We have built a labyrinth this last year with the idea that now we're going to have it open. It's in the courtyard, prayerful place. Yeah, no one comes. So we have to work on that. Yeah. Sure.
Why do you say inviting people to church on these times is dicey?
She said, why do you think inviting people to church is dicey? If you're inviting, well, my experience, maybe it's different for different people and places. My experience is that if you're inviting people who are not part of a church community and don't have a connection to it to come to your church, there's a barrier you have to get over. Because I think that right now in our culture, people don't view church as neutral. I think they view church kind of negatively. So you're trying to overcome that negative at the beginning. Like, you want me to, why would you want me there? What's that about, right? I think that's been my experience. I think it depends on, you know, maybe I'm just doing it wrong.
There's also been so many instances of church hierarchy being oppressive and not accepting, and that gets all throughout the media. And, you know, the sex scandal with the Catholic Church and other churches. So I think people tend to, especially with social media, tend to gravitate to that sort of scandalous news. And see, that's what religion is. That's what church is. Most of us know better. Yeah. And people deep down inside probably have doubts about that. But it's hard when somebody would come up to me and say, hey, come over here and see what I've got going on.
Yeah.
Like, I'm curious, so I would probably go.
Right.
But
so I think there's, yes, all that stuff with the scandal is true. I think that there's another reality as well that we just have to name, and that's that we have sort of based a model sometimes on, if you don't get more people, it's not going to work. So, like, we do building programs, and we even fund them with the idea that we'll grow at this rate each year, and that kind of stuff. And we also, I hear this a lot, where people say, hey, Pastor, can you help us? Our community wants to get a new youth group. It's like, well, why? Okay, that's sure. Why do you want a youth group? And if the answer is because we want our church to have a future, that's the wrong answer. Because that's about you. If you want to have a youth group because you care about the kids in your neighborhood and you want something for them, that's a good motivation. But you see what happens is sometimes there is this, people get this sense of like, you want me for your reasons, right? As opposed to you want me because you care about me.
Right.
And I think that's really important for us to do business with. Yes, Ruby.
Also, the unchurched, using that term loosely.
Right.
They think church is boring.
Yeah.
Well, and they're kind of right.
It is. It's boring a lot of the time. What? It can be fun.
We eat church and it's boring.
Yeah. Yeah, not church.
Somehow we figured out how to make the gospel boring.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a trick. It's a trick.
It's boring.
Yeah.
We have to make them know that God is fun.
Exactly. Well, I would say even beyond fun. It certainly is fun involved, but it's actually deep and meaningful and life-giving. All the things, when you ask people who aren't part of a church community, and there's all this research about this stuff, what are you looking for? It's like, they want spiritual connectedness and community, and they want to make a difference. They want their life to count for something. All the things that we say in the church, we want too. So then we have to take a look then at what is it that we're asking for people? What are we doing when they get there? And what are the barriers? And there's all these hospitality barriers that we do along the way. And I get, you know, some churches go the opposite direction. Some say, yeah, you're not going to understand this for a long time. That's certainly another way to go. But I think we have to be honest about it, right? And sometimes, I just think if we're boring, we're boring. That's not good. Yeah.
But when you get a common connection,
right?
Let's have a small group that likes to golf,
right?
A small group that likes to crochet,
right?
And you get in there and you realize once you have connected to a common interest,
right?
Then you can learn. Oh my goodness, we've got a scripture before the crochet. We've got. Let's
sure.
talk about. Let's come and have dinner together, and so then you pull people in from the level that they are. You
exactly.
meet them where they are and realize, hey, this is not so bad.
Exactly right.
You know?
Exactly right. Yes, sir.
Oh, well, actually, my friend here, John Masterson, just reminded me of something. We go to the same church. When I first came to that church to join it, mm-hmm. we were talking about hiking and backpacking, mm-hmm. and he said, well, John, every summer we go to this place called Holden Village on a hike.
Yeah.
And it's really neat. And I'd never been here before. Mm-hmm. I hadn't been backpacking for a long time. And John said, why don't you come with us?
So this is the long con from him to get you in. Sweet. Well done, sir.
It made me feel welcome.
Yeah.
You know,
excellent. Yes.
It's like a common interest.
Yeah.
And all this, very soon, I had all these new great friends that I
yeah.
didn't
And by know. The way, hiking together can be a spiritual practice.
Yeah, we mm-hmm.
Right?
If you saunter.
I mean, yeah. Right.
I heard about this guy, though. He's an Anglican priest in England. His name is Nicholas Gumble.
Mm-hmm.
And the church is dying out in England. Attendance yeah. is pretty poor. He didn't have much luck inviting people to church.
Right.
So he came up with this idea to come up with a series of like evening talks about what is Christianity
right.
all about. And what he found was a lot of English people were actually very curious about that, but they weren't really comfortable expressing it.
Mm-hmm.
So he called it Alpha, mm-hmm. you know, for the beginning, the first part
yeah.
of the beginning. And it took off like
that.
And people, like all kinds of people, started showing up to these lectures he was giving because they were interested.
Yep.
And they didn't want to like really go to church, but they wanted to know more.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly effective.
Yep, thank you.
It's a comment over here.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Our church does not have an offering.
Your church does not have an offering.
And when I
how do they get paid?
Out in the narthex is a
oh,
box
I see. Okay.
that's locked.
Yeah.
And if you want to contribute or tithe or whatever you want
right.
to do, that's between you and God.
Mm-hmm.
But our pastor feels so strongly that in where we're living right now is if you go to church, they want you there because they want
right.
your money.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, I don't mean to, there are lots of churches, especially a lot of new churches that are church plants that oftentimes, there's one that meets at our church, another congregation meets at our place called Sojourn Grace. It's a progressive church that came out of the evangelical background. So it's you know all the rock and roll stuff, but with you know gays and lesbians are welcome here, and so that kind of thing. And they have what they call their joy box, which they put out when people put money in, people clap or something, right? And there's different ways to do it. I think when I first came back to Christ Lutheran, they had a practice to say at the offering time, if this is your first time in church, please do not give. Your presence is the gift. I think that creates second-class citizenship. So I said, yeah, let's go ahead and just say to everybody, you can give or you cannot give, but we think that it's healthy to participate. If you want to, you can do it. Because I think, here's another story for that. It's like I was for 3 years in charge of a homeless shelter. And we had a service every Sunday night. And we always had an offering. And people would ask when they come and say, why would you take an offering with homeless people as the parishioners? And I say, because there's a dignity in giving.
Yep.
It's actually offensive to not ask. And I remember one time we had all these churches that would come and make dinner for people afterwards. So they would come to the service, and then right afterwards there was dinner. And as they were sitting in the service, one time this one woman, she didn't think that there would be an offering because it was a service with predominantly people who were on the street. And so she didn't bring her purse. And then when the offering came, right, she was standing next to a woman who was living on the street, and she was looking for, like she had nothing in her hands. And the person who she was standing next to took what she had, gave half to her to go ahead and put in the thing. That's dignity, right? That's, so we used to get, you know, sunflower seeds, bus tokens, ketchup packets from Taco Bell. I mean, all sorts of things in there with money, too. But to me, there's something about I can contribute that's really, really important. And I think that we want to give that to everybody. Now, we don't want to give the message of we need your money. We want to say instead, this is an opportunity for all of us to participate in the wider, and I'd say, our proper relationship with our money. You know, can't give it away, it's got you. Right.
Do you have any ideas for single people that feel that church is for, even if people aren't married, if they have kids,
yeah.
you know, is that they're They're not all by themselves.
Yeah, that's a tough one because we definitely organize ourselves, especially depending on which church you're talking about. But my mom, she went through that. You know, when my parents divorced, she didn't feel like she was really welcome. And no one said to her, "You're not welcome."
Yeah.
But everything that they used to do was, yeah.
If you have kids, that kind of is a little.
Yeah.
But if you don't have anybody but yourself,
right.
I know with our daughter, she does go with us to Easter. Well, everybody's got kids.
Right.
You know that.
Yeah, well, let me just be clear. Like, for example, churches oftentimes, they make like a big deal out of Mother's Day.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's problematic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
when you say to, like adventures and church stuff, when I first came to this church, the first time I was there, they had a practice of every woman who came in got a carnation. Red if your mother was alive, white if your mother was dead.
Oh.
So when people are walking up to church, they're like, "Oh, welcome for Mother's Day. Mother alive or dead?" Not exactly the way you want to start your day with people, right? We don't think about it. So we stop that. But I also think you have to take into consideration that in that room, you have people who have had a bad relationship with their mother. You have people who want to be mothers and can't.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
who, I mean, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Or people who've been told, you won't be complete unless you are a mother, and then you want to be a mother. All of the, and every spectrum, everyone on that whole spectrum is there too. So to say, we're now going to act as though this is what it means to be a woman and a mother, and there's a single thing is not helpful, right? So, but yet ignore it at your peril, right? So you have to, yeah. It's a needle we thread, right? We are over time. So I want to have one last slide, and that's this, just to say thank you to you for. This is my first time teaching at Heartland. I really had a great time. I really appreciate. The energy that all of you had. So I say to you, the divine in me sees the divine in you. Namaste.
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 Namaste. Namaste. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.